Good morning, everybody. We are on the internet right now. Welcome, everybody, to this second in-person meeting of ASAF. We have a lot of on the agenda for the next 2 days, and we'll start with discussion, a thorough discussion on disclosures. First, we're going to talk about the activities that we have undertaken in the last year or so. I give the floor to Christy to give an overview.
So I'll talk about what we're doing in the disclosure initiative, and I apologise to anybody who is in the World Standard Setters session tomorrow, because I'll give the overview, but still sort of would love to discuss it in this forum as well. Amy will go on to some more specific amendments we're proposing to IS1, and then after lunch we'll be discussing Kevin's paper, which he's forwarded and is in your papers. So to start, I thought it'd be worth to give you some context for what we're doing around disclosures and the project that we've termed the Disclosure Initiative. And just in terms of, what I'm referring to is Agenda Paper 8A for the September meeting, which I think was referenced as 1B2 in your papers. So on slide... in the background, what I will cover is give you a bit of reason of where we've got to, how we've got to where we are at the moment, what is the disclosure problem, what we perceive it to be, some of the next steps that we're proposing, and the different projects or streams that make up this disclosure initiative, and then a bit of a timeline and a link back to the conceptual framework. So on page 3, it gives you a bit of background of how we've got to where we've got to. So I hope everybody's got the slides, found them. In the agenda consultation in 2011, we had a strong message that a disclosure framework is needed to ensure that information disclosed is more relevant to investors and to reduce the burden on preparers. And in response, we said that we would bring in or look at a disclosure framework as part of the conceptual framework. In addition, what we would do was to hold a forum, a discussion with a broad range of people involved in the financial reporting process to see if we could do some things within the current within current IFRS to address some of the issues that we're hearing about disclosures. And so we held a forum in January to obtain views from a wide range of people and get everybody in the room. In conjunction with that, and just before that, we also issued or put out a survey, again, to get a real sense of what is the problem. We're hearing a lot of different messages and different descriptions, and we wanted to get a view of what that problem was from different angles. So it went out to users, preparers, regulators, other people, and we got a good sense, you know, good responses. And we used that information in the discussion forum to build what we hoped would be a good structure and a good discussion. As a result of that, we issued a feedback statement which had summarised the messages that we heard in that forum and in the survey. And I think at some point there, it became apparent that the issues that and the breadth of issues that needed to be addressed were more than were going to be addressed in the conceptual framework itself. The conceptual framework being limited to principles and high-level principles and constrained by the nature of the conceptual framework, but the depth and the I suppose the level of application of some of the disclosure issues were going to be better dealt with in a project or an initiative, if you like, outside of the conceptual framework. So that has meant that we've developed what we call this disclosure initiative, and I'll bring you into some, in the next slides, go through what that entails. So if I move to the next slide, so what is the problem with disclosures? What were those messages that we heard in the discussion and from the survey? And on slide 5, you know, you've got lots of arrows going there, but I think that sort of gives you an indication of the varied messages that we did hear. And if I sort of go around, I think one of the, you know, some of the items that are listed or arranged here, not applying materiality, we get this sense that people are unwilling or unable or for some reason unable to use their judgment when applying the concept of materiality. A checklist approach, we heard that a lot, definitely in the survey. You know, we heard of it since, you know, people are reliant for whatever reason on a checklist. It's easier to use a checklist when determining what disclosure to make rather than to use judgment. We heard one story that was, we even had a checklist for the checklist just because there were so many that people had to use these days. It wasn't all just, some of these are quite behavioural in some ways, but I think there's also a sense that the way that we write standards wasn't helpful, so that, you know, lack of clarity in some of the standards we had written have contributed to what we see as the disclosure problem. And there weren't the incentives there not to disclose, so some of the legal and institutional barriers for not disclosing meant that sometimes it was safer to make a disclosure rather than to not make that disclosure, and that real sense of compliance and not communication. So they're just a few of the messages that we had heard, but it did mean that if I go to the next page on slide six, I mean, there's actually lots of ways you could describe what the disclosure problem is. I know in the survey, the way that we tried to articulate it was sort of a three sort of pronged, faceted problem, being not enough relevant information. That was very much supported by users. Too much irrelevant information, which is, I think, the disclosure overload, which, you know, many preparers talk about. And I think poor communication was identified as one, an aspect which all people thought could be improved. I think overall, though, there was a sense that disclosures aren't as effective and working hard enough as they could be, and there were steps that we could do to try and address that. So if I move to slide, it'll be slide eight, which really gives you a single snapshot of the projects or the streams that we're looking at addressing as part of the disclosure initiative. And this really summarises the ISB's response set out in the feedback statement. So it tries to articulate and bring together those messages that we've heard about disclosures. And it's got, as you can see, five projects or streams, because I think one in particular may not necessarily be a project as such, but a bit of more a process and an activity. But five project or streams, and they split them between short-term, and I think that's a broad sense of short-term, and long-term, and which I think you could think long-term or medium-term. And I'll go through each of these streams in a bit more detail in the next slide. So if I move to the first project, and this is some amendments to IS1, we see this as a short-term project, and this is what Amy's going to talk a bit more about next, but we have brought a first paper to the board in September, and that's been included in the papers that we have sent to you. And this is, and we're hoping to get out an exposure draft of these proposed changes by the first quarter next year. Now, these really address what we perceive to be some overly literal interpretations of some of the wording in IS1. And we think they're perhaps not necessarily the correct interpretations or what the board intended when they wrote some of the guidance in IS1. There's not a lot of basis of conclusions for these particular paragraphs because they are, they carried over from the existing IS1 standard. So we hope that some of these clarifications will, one, give users a sense, or preparers, or whoever's using those standards, a sense of what is meant behind those actual paragraphs, and give them a basis to have a better discussion about how they should be applied. If I go to slide 10, these list some of those clarifications that we're proposing to make. And I won't go into detail, but this is what Amy is going to cover. One thing that's not covered in the paper, which we brought in September, is a consideration of whether we should require or permit a reconciliation of net debt. We've heard a lot from users that that would be a useful disclosure. We're going to be bringing a paper in October on that matter. If I move to slide 11, just the other thing that we're doing with IS1, which isn't related to the disclosure initiative but is running at the same time, is some issues that were highlighted to us via the IFRIC Interpretations Committee, or the IFRIC, and they relate to going concern, the split between current and non-current liabilities, and the presentation of items of other comprehensive income from equity accounted investments. And the board is looking at those at the same time as we're proposing these disclosure initiative changes. So we're going to group them together like we would do an annual improvement, so that the board and our constituents can look at those amendments as a package rather than issuing a number of EDs on IS1. I move to slide 12. This is the second of the, I'm going to say, short-term projects, but it's going to be a longer term than the work we're doing on IS1. We have started the very first stages of this project. We've already had discussion with the IAASB and IOSCO just to see whether we should own the project on materiality and be the body that's issuing guidance on materiality. I know that ESMA, for example, had issued a consultation and had received a strong message that if guidance was needed, it was the remit of the ISB to be making that guidance. This really project responds to a sense that materiality is not being applied well in practice. The board did consider the concept of materiality in the conceptual framework project and deserted that. It felt that the concept of materiality was clear, but there was problems in application of that concept. So, as I said, we'll be working with auditors, regulators and others to work on materiality. And the result, though, or the output of this project is yet unclear. What we're proposing to do is some research in the next few months and bring a paper to the board in the first quarter of next year to recommend, taking into account the guidance that we already have or that there is, whether we need to issue more guidance, and to give a very clear view about what the scope and the objective of any guidance would be and what the form of that guidance would be. It may not necessarily be an amendment to an IFRS. It may be educational. It may be something else. But that's what the sort of initial phases of this project will be, and that's sort of the phase we're at the moment. And I'll come back and ask you some sort of questions on whether we're going to hit the right scopes on that. The next project or stream, and this is the one which I'm not sure we would call a project as such, is on slide 13, where we review new disclosure requirements. So as new EDs are being developed, we would see an ongoing process to make sure that we are writing them in the best way that we can. So, for example, I think over the last few standards or recent standards, we have developed a disclosure objective and have written that subject to that objective or applying that objective, an entity shall disclose XYZ examples. So we'd look whether that should be a shall or for example, maybe sort of a greater emphasis on defining that objective, the objective that has been developed in many of the old centres. It has sort of worked off each other. You can see a similarity between the objectives, whether that's the right way or whether they need to be more clearly focused, whether we perhaps should do a longer list of examples. There's sort of a way of exploring the best way to write disclosures. I think the other aspect of this is a process aspect, and when should disclosures be addressed in the standard setting process, and how should there be certain questions staff should be asking the board or themselves or constituents in order to develop those. So I think there's some process aspects about this as well, that which we need to formalise into some either process document or some sort of way that we write standards. I think this also, I hope, would build, like the materiality section too, on the work that we've done on the conceptual framework so far. So it builds on the concept of materiality, and I'd hope this ED, or this ongoing aspect of writing new standards will sort of build on where we're going with the conceptual framework and the chapter on disclosures and presentation and the objectives that are being set within there. Now, if I move to slide 14, this is the first of a longer project, which will be a research project in its initial phases. And this is a project which would look to whether the board should replace IS1, IS7 and IS8, and also bring in the work that we've done on the financial statement presentation project. And again, this is in its very initial phases, and we'll start work on this in the next few weeks. It really, I think what we're going to be doing is work on whether... this is actually one of the questions I'm going to ask you about, how the scope of what we're going to hit with this project. But it will run in parallel with the conceptual framework, and I think we'll really pick up where the conceptual framework will end, will finish to a certain extent. I'm thinking in terms of a relay, it will take the baton on from where the conceptual framework will finish it, and it will move on. So in lots of ways, I think this project or stream will incorporate or look like that disclosure framework which people had been requesting in the agenda consultation, in the forum and the survey. And then if I move to slide 15, that the last project again is a longer term one and would be a research one over the next 2 years, and that's the review of existing standards. And I think that's going to be reliant on one where we get to in the replacement of IS1, IS7 and IS8 in the FSP project. If we see that as being a disclosure framework, how we deal with existing standards will be reliant on where we come to on that. I think it's also going to be very reliant on where we end up in the conceptual framework as well. So this is going to be something, I think, that we will develop over the next 2 years, but I see it as the, I suppose, the final link into the chain. So if I move to the timeline, which is on slide 17, this pulls together the different streams and gives you a sense of when we're proposing to issue or work on the various streams in the disclosure initiative. As you see, we've already started some work on IS1 and materiality is already underway, and we're about to start the research phase of the replacement of IS1, 7 and 8 in the FSP project. I think then if I move to slide 19, then what we're trying to do with this slide is show you that it's running, that how this project, this initiative links into the conceptual framework. And as I said, I think the two sort of streams on materiality and the amendments to IS1 and the ongoing standards really sort of are building on the work we're doing in the conceptual framework. And I see the later two research projects really picking up or taking the baton on forward from what the conceptual framework is doing. But that, you know, these projects are informing each other. I mean, both Amy and I are working on the conceptual framework as well, and being responsible for the disclosure and presentation chapters or sections of that conceptual framework. So they are cross-informing each other. So I think that's all for the actual presentation, but I think the things that we really wanted to ask you, and I think there's three broad areas that we'd like to sort of get a sense from you. One, as an overall package, are we hitting the right points? Are there things that we are not included in this initiative that we should be including? I would then like to go on and ask you some specific, well, a more direct question about the materiality project. What should be the scope of that project? Should we be doing something? What might be the final form of that? And then more on the replacement of IS1, IS7 and IS8 in the FSP project. I'll just call that the disclosure framework because it's quicker. But again, is that what, you know, what should be the scope of that? Is the timeline looking okay on that? What should we be looking at on that project? So if I go back to that first question, which is, if I look at this disclosure initiative overall, and also any other questions you had on this as well, if I look at this disclosure initiative overall, are we hitting the right points, and is there anything else that we should be looking at or be dealing with?
Roger.
Well, it's difficult to answer one without also answering three, so I'm afraid I'm going to jump onto three as well. I think it's an excellent package of proposals, so I think it will be a major step forward. I think I'm just worried about three, about over-ambition. I think, you know, so IS1 has other interesting and very controversial issues in it as well, and I'm just worried that if you start reopening the whole of those three standards, it may take an awful long time to actually make progress, as opposed to making progress in the disclosure issues.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my concern. The other general issue I make is, I don't think you can actually answer some of these questions without thinking about boundaries of financial statements. And I know that the conceptual framework didn't want to go there, but I do think you have to decide what should go within financial statements and what should go outside. And it's natural for accounting standard setters to say, well, this is really desirable, let's mandate it, even though arguably another place in the overall financial reporting would be a better place to put it. So I do think the ISB needs some sort of overall philosophy about what goes where, and you can write, as you have for the OFR, for example, you've written a sort of best practice or whatever, you know, this is what we'd recommend. And to some extent, I think that's information that doesn't naturally fit in financial statements. You could put it into that sort of thing, but I do think you should put it into financial statements. So that's one half of it. The other half is, it doesn't really mention technology. And I think this research project, I'm sure that you mean to go there, which is to say, well, if we decide we want this information, where's the best place to put it? And part of the disclosure overload problem is there's more and more data which is useful every year. It doesn't naturally fit, though, all of it within a normal financial report or financial statements, but maybe it should go somewhere. And I rather admire the proposals, for example, in the impairment disclosures, perhaps take some of the stuff offline and just say, this is where you can find it, rather than you have to put another 20 pages in the financial statements. So I think that third bit needs to address technology and where it goes, as well as what should be disclosed.
I think your first point is a very valid one. What are the boundaries? What should be the boundaries of disclosures?
Yeah.
I think, Russ, you have that conversation with your investors, for example, on leases, where they say, well, we don't want it on a balance sheet, but we would like about 100 forward-looking disclosures. And which in terms of being a burden on companies might be a lot heavier than what we are proposing. And I think when we are going to discuss Kevin's paper, this will also be an important part of that discussion. How far can we go with financial reporting?
Do you think that's something that should be I think that's going to have to be closely tied to the conceptual framework as well, that, that boundary issue. And there's been some idea of trying to do that through the, looking at the types of information that should be disclosed in the financial statements. And there are different types to what Kevin proposes, but it, it, that same idea that there's certain types of information that are financial statement driven, and if it's information about that, then it goes in the financial statements. So would you think sort of something along those lines, whatever that may be, would be a good workplace to start in that, yeah, in that thinking?
Placement criteria. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the FRC and EFRAG and others have actually written a paper about disclosure outside the notes, i.e. what should go where. You know, there's governance types of disclosures. They don't naturally fit in financial statements. They do fit naturally in an overall financial report, for example. So I'd commend that paper.
And Roger, on your point on technology, how do you think we should handle that as a standard setter? I mean, there's kind of a lot of areas in that, isn't there?
I agree, and technology moves so fast that you can't actually end up with some timeless statements. But one should recognise that, that technology now allows things that, that the old paper-style financial reports doesn't. So recognising that you can end up with easy ways of going from an annual report to some more granular information that weren't available 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, I think is important. But you can't get too much into the specifics of the technology because that changes all the time.
But does that give us an excuse for more disclosures? Because we say we can pop them down further down the technology line?
Well, or, at least possibly it allows companies options, you know, of telling a story which might appeal to a lot of the users, whilst at the same time allowing some of those more detailed disclosures, which are important, to be elsewhere. But I understand the excuse angle, but I don't think it gives you an excuse to say, well, we can now mandate almost everything, anything, because you don't have to put it in the annual report.
In terms of auditability and the preciseness with which these disclosures have to be delivered, I don't think it makes a difference whether you put it in a written statement or technologically available. So in that respect, it is not necessarily less burdensome for entities to do equal.
I start with the general remarks. We appreciate the effort of the ISD try to optimize the volume and improve the overall quality of disclosures. So we have feedback from our stakeholders that the future steps proposed by the ISD are welcomed, which is not a usual thing.
Is it not just politeness?
Can I go into the specific concern regarding the net debt? We know that stakeholder from a particular region strongly encourage the ISB to require disclosing net debt reconciliation, and currently net debt reconciliation is considered to be taken at the first step of the short steps. So in the amendment to IS1, but in Japan we have not had a strong message from stakeholders, including users community. So we have no places, we have no people to tell us how, why, and what the good thing of this disclosure. So, and one more thing is addition of net debt reconciliation should reduce scattered notes. It was said in your response, but we don't know how you reduce other notes. So, at this point. So careful consideration is needed, and one more thing is net debt reconciliation seem to me to be similar with cash flow statement. This thing should be carefully considered with other issues within the whole package.
Mm-hmm. Ross?
Thanks, Hans. As probably most of you know, we've had a disclosure framework project on the FASB's agenda for a few years. I think it's a very important project, both for the FASB and the ISB. I think there is too much disclosure out there, and a lot of times the important disclosure is obfuscated by the less important. What we've discovered is that, at least in the U.S., companies are not incentivized to voluntarily reduce their disclosures. Some companies have done that, but by far the majority are not incentivized. And the primary reason for that is investors in the U.S., they compare and contrast the new disclosure to the prior disclosures, and if there are changes, they wonder why there are changes. Also, with respect to your observations about materiality, what we've observed in the U.S. is that if the standard setter says you are required or you shall, that means it is interpreted as you must do it. And if you don't do it, that's considered an error. And then companies have to evaluate whether or not that error is material, which means you'd have to document it. You'd have to document your basis for why it's not material. You'd have to compile individually and aggregate. The auditor is then required to ask management to represent that. And then the auditor is required to communicate it to the audit committee. All that increases the burden from the preparer and the auditor and really is a disincentive to having the preparer not include the disclosures. What we have started to do in our disclosures as well as in the measurement and recognition is for the standard setter to basically say you only have to do this if it's significant, or the standard setter put the threshold in, and that way the preparer could make the judgment, and if the preparer chose it wasn't significant, it's not considered an error, it's not considered something that should have been done. Also with respect to materiality and the basis for determining whether something is or is not material is a legal distinction in the United States pursuant to securities law, and has actually been interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court, which is the highest court of jurisdiction in our country. And so all the details application guidance of materiality has been promulgated by the Securities and Exchange Commission under the philosophy that it is a securities law item. Thank you.
So you basically increased the threshold from material to significant.
The thought is that if the standard says, and name the threshold, it doesn't matter, but the standard setter looks and evaluates and says you don't have to do it if significant, you don't have to do it if, and we put in that, then the company may make the judgment, and it's based on the company's judgment, versus if you say you shall do it, and then the company doesn't do it, they then have to prove that it's not material.
Liesl?
Roger more or less triggered my train of thoughts. The scope of what you do soon and what you do in the midterm or long term is, of course, difficult to set, and some would want some things immediately and some other things to be given some more thought. And, of course, some of us more than others are inclined to see the financial report as the whole and have that other part which the ISB does not fully cater for yet. And my train of thought then, on the one hand, led me to IFRS 7. Of course, you don't want to up all sorts of Pandora boxes at the same time. Of course, IFRS 7 is a classical example where you have a number of disclosures which other people would immediately put into the management commentary, or however you would call it, and not really in the traditional note disclosure, because all your risk management strategy and all that to us belongs into a different context, more or less. As you already consider a sort of enhanced cooperation on materiality with regulators, maybe you could broaden that, because to my understanding at least, you've been avoiding the MD&A or management commentary or whatever, because it's clearly regulatory territory, at least in some areas of the world, and as long as the regulators say hands off, you've been very cautious not to tread on each other's toes, but sooner or later I guess you'll have to face that, and I would be very much in favor if very cautiously you would go down that path, because to avoid it in the long term, I don't think it's possible.
Pastor?
Thank you. Well, I would like to support the support already expressed for the initiative, and also the necessity of defining the boundary of financial statements. In addition, and I probably as little puts it in the camp of those who would like to see more in the short-term period than in the long-term period, I would question, in fact, if you have already the keys on how to write better EDs, why would the improvement of existing standards have to be a long-term project? If you know how to do it, why not launch the revision at the same time?
Good point.
The second point I wanted to make is whether you could consider, as part of your short-term IS1 amendments, some work around the communication principles. We had found in our work on these that they look simple, elementary, but desperately not applied in practice. So in addition to improving, helping people do a better job on disclosures, that could be a nice addition. And that does not necessarily have to wait. I would also join in the comment made by Roger about the longer term project, as you put it, on IS1, IS7, IS8, as being a much wider scope than the disclosure initiative requires.
Can I ask the staff, first of all, I think Constance made a good point that we have already new wordings in our latest standards, less restrictive wordings in our latest standards. I suppose they correspond pretty much with that would be my question, but since we developed many standards together, I suppose that corresponds with what Russ just told about the situation in the United States. And secondly, I think it's a very valid point. If we know what the trick is, does it need to take a long time to revisit the current standards?
The only problem is when you open up standards for a very narrow reason and we're just going to change the wording, you often open Pandora's box on a whole lot of things, like do you need that disclosure at all, never mind whether it's just worded right. So I don't think it'll be as simple as...
Yeah. I was going to ask a couple of questions about that, because two things have come up. One, Russ suggested you are going to be using the word if it's significant when or something in relation to disclosure. ICAS and NZICA, the New Zealand Scottish Institute, suggested we add the word materiality, you know, I might have said 453 times or something like that, to emphasise that in each of the disclosure things. And so one of the approaches is to emphasise materiality or significance or something around the disclosures. Although I don't know what significant means, by the way. But the other one, we've got a...
Don't worry, the SEC will tell you in general.
Don't get hung up on the word significant. There are various ways. For example, in revenue recognition, we talk about what is the objective of disclosures, and I think the mistake we made in the Exposure Act was we said, here's the objective, and then we had four pages of requirements that you had to do to fulfill the objective. I think that's what we should avoid doing. I think we should talk about the objective. I think we should talk about things management should consider in evaluating the objective. And I think there's a difference between what management should consider and what management shall do. And that's the tone difference. The term, and so there you're allowing management to make the judgment rather than telling management exactly what it is they have to do. That's the distinction I'm trying to make.
And we did it even worse than that, right? We said, here's the objective, here's the list that you have to follow to meet the objective, and then we wrote language that says, and if you still haven't met the objective after doing all this, do more.
I agree, but one of the points I think comes back to Ian's comment is that if you go back to some of the older standards where we say shall or must, and you take away that word, have a look at the objective, and you might find that we actually don't have a clear objective in there. And I think our concern is that you open up something Because I agree that there are some of the standards are the worst. It says at a minimum an entity shall. Now, I don't know how a general materiality clause overrides at a minimum. That's one of the challenges. So those are the first ones I'd go to. But I'm really worried about saying, well, you know, we spent years thinking about recognition and measurement and stuff, and the disclosure package is supposed to go with that because it's a holistic thing. And now we're just going to open up the disclosure, take away those horrible words that says shall, and without necessarily thinking about how clear the objective is. And that was our worry. Otherwise, we'd say, yeah, let's go and do it. And I think the other thing, too, is even with the new stance of the EDs, it's still a bit of a... we've had a bit of feedback. I had a partner in a Big Four firm came up to me after one meeting and said, we can't work with these, you have to give us a list, because we can't work with a general objective. It's too vague. So we have to see whether it's going to work. One of the other options I throw
it's
out...
a good sign, actually.
Exactly, it is a good sign. One of the other options I throw out is that maybe our list should be longer, but deliberately overlapping. You can't have a checklist when things overlap and you say that these are the types of things. Well, maybe the auditing firms can have a checklist, but the idea is to show that this is a smorgasbord or a list of things that you should draw from as opposed to meeting, because they do deliberately overlap. So, and that might be more helpful to give flesh to the objective of the type of information. So those are things we're looking at. And I think we're a little early to say that we're quite there yet with it, because we have to see how practice deals with this.
Anna?
Yes, thank you. I think, well, as a general comment, I think the package you have presented is a very good package, and it will clarify a lot of concerns that have arose about disclosure. We, as standard setters, we have received two main complaints or concerns. One from users, who say that they say that disclosure is not entity specific, and they find the checklist approach useless. And the other one from preparers, who complain about duplication of disclosures. So I think with this project you have, these concerns might be solved.
Alexander?
Just a way to organize my mind, I used to think about this disclosure problem or disclosure error in two kinds of. Type one error, when you provide information that is irrelevant, / immaterial. And a type two error, when you do not provide information which is relevant, / material. I believe that I attack the first error. It's type one. And in my view, I would go even stronger in that direction, because I agree with what Russo said, because every time that you give an example in these standards, like you could, for example, disclose that way. In practice, in the real world, it becomes almost mandatory. So
and
it becomes guidance. So and the company is very, very, very in a situation to be better to be safe than sorry, and forget materiality. And you mentioned stock options, you mentioned related party transactions, but I can mention other standards like employee benefits. If you look at the amount of disclosure on employee benefits, and most of it, I don't believe that's quite relevant.
Well, I think then it's
my point is just every time this standard specifically mentions something about it, it tends to be in practice mandatory, and companies have a very, very difficult situation not to disclose it, even if it's not material.
And I think we're trying to make sure that people have the tools to be able to apply that materiality and say, even if it is an example, IS1 at the moment does override that, and you, if it's not material, there is no requirement to disclose.
Yeah, but the problem is that materiality is a conceptual framework which is not. Does not override any specific stance. I heard that from authors several times. Say, well, this is not material. Say, well, but look at this standard. They say that you should disclose that and that and that information.
It is in IS1 as well, but you know, we have heard that message that even though it's sitting in IS1, people feel reticent to apply it to specific disclosure requirements in standard. And it's one of the proposals Amy is going to go through is trying to beef up that requirement or that guidance in IS1 about materiality. Will that be sufficient? Or, you know, we have heard messages that people want us to filter or to put the word materiality or something along those lines in each of the individual standards just to give them that extra body. I think, you know,
the board had decided some time ago to limit the discussion of materiality to IS1.
No, that's my point. I understand. I believe you are in the right direction. But just to mention that every standard that mentions anything about disclosure, give an example, so suggestion, it tends to become, in practice, almost mandatory. You must be very brave not to disclose something which is suggested in a standard. So you have to explain. You have to explain it to thousands of people.
But sometimes you only have one example, and that's the problem. If you have just one example of how you could disclose it, it almost becomes the default. If we give you two or three ways that you might convey the same information, then you're starting to suggest there are different ways of communicating.
I give you just to give an example, is in your question number four, you said you proposed to change the entity normally presents to entity could, for example. I don't believe that nothing's going to change. Because the ISB says that you could, for example, most of people say, well, that's the way I should go, in my opinion. It becomes guidance, especially in certain parts of the world, there are different legal tradition that tends to see what's written in a less principle-based way of looking at this, even worse than what he mentioned in the U.S. So I'll go even stronger. I put stronger words here.
Stronger words around.
Again,
necessarily need to disclose it if it's not
material. Or don't give any guidance. Just put principles and don't give an example. Or the opposite way. Don't give an example. If you want people to change the order, don't give an example. Just say put the principles and
Linda.
Thank you. So I want to warn everybody that I'm thinking about this a little bit from my background as preparer, not necessarily just as a standard setter. But I kind of liken the concept we're talking about here to my taxi ride from the airport on Saturday night, where the taxi driver was getting frustrated because they were putting up the barricades for the bike race, and so he kind of went down one way and had to turn back a little. But ultimately, we got to the hotel. So. This is going to be a project that is worth doing, and there might be some false starts, but I'd certainly throw in my support to doing this. But I think we need to be realistic about what can be accomplished in the short term versus the long term, and I think we need to be realistic about what can be accomplished through the standard setter versus other guidance. So in June, I was speaking at a financial executive conference, and there were a lot of what I'll call medium-sized preparers in Canada in the room, and the comment was made that they felt that the financial statements had become irrelevant because there was so much disclosure. So that's an indication that we are dealing with a real issue. But if I put my hat on as large preparers in Canada, typically who are dual-listed, and if the SEC now has about 450 foreign private issuers issuing statements under IFRS, Canada is more than half of that. They're confronted with some of the things that Russ was talking about, and confronted with disclosure requirements that come from a lot of other places besides what is written in the IFRS standards. And so we have to be realistic about how much we can actually accomplish by doing this. In fact, there is a disincentive for a preparer not to do a disclosure, and it really comes about as if you're going to issue shares and you're going to put a prospectus out there, you're going to want to avoid any liability in terms of not disclosing things in that document or in the financial statements that you incorporate by reference in those documents. So I think this is a great thing to do. I think that if you, what may seem logical to you, that it was never the ISB's intention for immaterial disclosures to be disclosed, the fact is there is a compliance mentality. We talk about what are the financial statements for communication or compliance. Well, they're actually hopefully for both, but there is a compliance mentality. And I think the other thing that we need to consider is that you've talked about regulators, but I think you have to have a very broad notion of what you mean by regulators, because there's also banking regulators who require disclosures for banks and financial institutions, and there's also audit regulators where the auditors are mindful of the fact that they've got someone looking over their shoulders, and so they're going to continue to have that, some of that checklist mentality. So those are things I would urge you to consider in terms of really assessing the outcome of what you may be able to accomplish in the long term versus the short term versus the long term.
It was definitely something that came out in the forum, that there's only so much the board or the ISB can do, and that there's a lot of behaviour related to this disclosure problem, and it's a point that maybe as part of this process or this journey that we go through to do this disclosure work is that communication and letting people know what we're doing will be important, because I think it's, you know, if we take the IS1 proposals, we don't think they're a significant change in many cases, but we're hoping that they can change someone's behaviour. So that's something we have to try and bring into this project, is that behaviour aspect and what we can do to initiate or start the ball rolling in other areas.
Yeah. But you will never hear any of us promising a significant reduction in disclosures, because we are very careful raising false expectations.
Looking at the Canadian context, I think there's that glut of medium Canadian registrants only who probably could actually achieve some reductions and some rationalization of the disclosures as a result of the work that you're proposing. But I'm not clear that for the bigger companies who are heavily doing prospectus activity around the world and things like that, that you can make that difference.
Yeah.
It's not clear to me.
Yeah. Kevin?
I think everything that Linda just said could be said from the Australian environment as well. I just ticked off each of the points you made. They're very relevant. I guess the critical advice you're looking for from us is, should you proceed broadly in the manner that you're outlining? And I would strongly support that. I think it's been insightful to see that there could be ways in the standards of making some progress here before tackling maybe more fundamental issues about how to go about disclosure. So I think that insightfulness should be applauded and taken on. Of course, it brings with it attention, and I think, Christy, you were saying that you've got to look in many directions as you proceed, keeping an eye on how the framework develops, etc. And that's the dilemma, I think. The quicker you come to what you think are good ideas, maybe the faster you'll depart from something that eventually comes out of the framework. And so I think Linda's comment about maybe go down some wrong directions and have to redirect over time is absolutely valid, and it's a risk I think worth taking. In Australia, our Financial Reporting Council had a project on, they started out by reducing complexity, and then they decided they better not go down that track because they had no province in the technical side of IFRS. So they, I think, wisely changed it to managing complexity. And I think virtually all of the issues that you have brought out were brought out in that same study. So it's just another set of eyes with another set of data coming to a similar outcome. There were, and I think it's worth reflecting that we're all here now talking about this. The wave for change is already rolling.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are seeing people in Australia starting to experiment with some of those ideas. Anecdotally, I'm seeing people cutting down their accounting policy notes and trying to be a bit more sensible about their approach. One of the big four firms has taken its example set of financial statements and recast it into what might be more typical of an entity. You know, usually when you're constructing those example sets of accounts, you try to cover everything that any client might face, and the consequence is when they do the checklist against it, everybody does everything, and that's not very sensible. But seeing a firm react like that and trying to get messages across to its client is good. One of the other things that was asserted by many preparers was that the Securities Commission didn't share the standard setter's view of materiality, and we didn't think that was right, so we spoke directly with the with the Australian Securities and Investments Commission. Their view of the standard was perfectly correct. And so we encouraged them to make a couple of statements publicly along those lines, and they have. And I think that's all helping the atmosphere as well. And I think, Hans, with your understanding with IOSCO, there's an opportunity there at some point to almost globally have that type of message delivered. There was a bit of preoccupation in the FRC's discussions with technology too, and I felt very uneasy about some of it, because the line was, let's get out of the mentality of a published set of financial statements where we can say that the financial report starts on page 55 and ends on 95 and the auditor says that's what he's auditing on. Let's think more electronic, where the data might be published annually, or it may be published in some sort of standing form through the year, and the standing form would, you know, just carry on, reduce the periodic reporting. And the analogy was drawn to a 10K report. There may be merit in that idea of splitting variable from standing data. I'm not convinced myself. It will be a challenge to auditors to ensure that the standing data is actually standingly audited, but maybe that's a different...
What is the analogy with the 10K?
Well, the observation has been made... If you compare an annual report in the US with one in Australia, the Australian one's much thicker. Is there less disclosure in the US than in Australia? No. The information is placed in different places. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's an empirical question. Why are US reports relatively thin compared to other parts of the world, particularly if risk suppliers? It's counterintuitive, but I think it's true. So you've got a benefit you're not aware of, Russ.
Yeah.
Just tell people that something worse could happen to them.
Next time they complain, I'll just say, go look and I'll show you.
Yeah.
But the surmise in Australia is it's because the 10K has a lot of standing data there that takes pressure away from what you would need to put in the annual report. The only thing I would encourage you to do is sort of stay away from things like net debt, which I think will just be a distraction from That's a disclosure item that may be argued for or against, irrespective of this project. Why is it in this project? Just another additional disclosure. Well, we could probably come up with quite a long list of other additional disclosures. And in doing that, the message going out to people is, no, you're not reducing. You're actually thinking up new things. There is a mood of change. Take advantage of it. And that's why I'm strongly supportive of the shorter term focus on this. We should take advantage of it. Ken?
Thank you. Yeah, just to also reiterate some of the points that have been made, that, you know, we get a lot of criticism that financial statements are no longer useful, relevant, and particularly in a South African environment where our regulator requires integrated reports to be presented. There seems to be this view, well, that's where the relevant information is, that's where the useful information is. You know, these financial statements, it's a compliance exercise, yes, we have to do it, nobody sees any value, nobody reads these things, but they now are looking to the integrated report. So I guess the question would be is, well, you know, I think we need to look very carefully at how the annual financial statements, yes, you know, traditionally been prepared, how do they fit in with integrated reporting, because again it does seem hard to believe that we should have two almost competing means of communication. And you know, is it appropriate that the annual financial statements are sort of being relegated just to a compliance basis, and is it right that the integrated reporting is now presenting what is perceived to be more useful and relevant information? I guess it does tie in with Roger's comment about the boundary of financial statements, which I suppose, again, the integrated report is meant to be integrating, well, financial elements with a whole bunch of other elements as well. But the question would be is, even in that integrated report, well, what should be the basis of that financial information? So I really think that, you know, we need to work closely with Integrated Reporting Council to understand how all of these pieces then, fit together. Also, picking up on that point about the boundary of financial statements, I think in order to try and address the issue around disclosures, we really need to have, I guess, a better understanding of the users of financial statements and what information do they require. And I suppose maybe just picking up on this net debt reconciliation, well, why is that something which has been considered? So, you know, which user is now believing that this is useful information? And so what are the drivers? Because I do think that sometimes, and I suppose this does go back to the standard setting objectives for the disclosures, but a lot of people then say, well, you know, what's the point of X? So the standard says I need to disclose X, I don't think it's relevant, it doesn't mean anything, etc. And so often there's then other resistance to it. Now, is that because they don't understand the purpose of it? Or, you know, are we trying to provide information which informs people about how future cash flows are going to be affected? And if something doesn't really fit into that, well, then what is the point of disclosing it? And I think as well, the more users we try and cater to in the financials, again, the broader the information. I mean, if somebody is analysing, employee benefit obligations, maybe for them it would be very useful to know a whole lot of information. But is that really, again, the purpose of the financial statement? So I think in order to move forward on making the financial statements more relevant, we really need to have a clearer idea of, well, who are those users and what is the nature of the information that is then driving their decisions, which should then inform why this disclosure is relevant. And so again, on this net debt reconciliation, and if it is going to be put on the table, well, the question would be is, well, what purpose does it serve? So why, you know, is that now a specific requirement? Also, just to touch on the materiality, certainly very supportive of the short-term proposals. And I was very interested with the comment that Russ made about the materiality. I mean, is there a difference between materiality from a recognition and measurement perspective versus disclosure? You know, I mean, often you'll find that certain items are not material from a recognition perspective, but does that mean that if a preparer doesn't comply, then they are in non-compliance and that's an error and then you've got to motivate it? I would have thought that materiality underpins all of that. So, you know, you shouldn't even get into the fact that there's non-compliance if it's not material. And I would have thought the same thing would have and should have come through on the disclosure. So I believe that as a short-term fix, I understand, I think that is what is being emphasized, and so certainly I'm very supportive of that. And then just on the materiality as well, I think that although a comment was made that the concept is clear, it's perhaps the practical application. Maybe we just need to test, is the concept clear? You know, often we have debates around the fact that, you know, is materiality in the context of the financial statements as a whole? So you may find that it, as a whole, maybe a particular line item, let's say it's $1 million, whatever the currency happens to be, overall that is not material. But if we only have that, let's say that line item, if it were to be shown separately, and that $1 million is, you know, 99% wrong, is that a problem because you've shown it on a line basis? So is it material to a line basis? And then when you look at then the disclosures, something might not be material in the context of the financial statements as a whole, but people might say, well, for that line item, goodness, maybe if certain elements change, that number could double. But so I think there could be some, you know, uncertainty around the application of materiality, and I think perhaps maybe that needs to be clarified. Is it in the context of the financial statements as a whole? You know, and how does one then deal with individual line items, for example? So I think
It would be useful if that same sort of question about materiality arose at the board discussion, which we were, you know, we think it's something we need to deal with in that materiality project. I mean, the question that you raise is actually, is it the concept itself that, rather than its application? In the conceptual framework discussion paper, we have asked a question as to whether, you know, we saying that we haven't addressed materiality because we think it's clear. Do you agree with that? So it would be interesting to see if we get some responses on that point.
Just pick one, Ross, unfair to ask you because you're not a securities regulator, but from what you understand about the application materiality in the US, do the regulators think of it as material, to Kim's point, as a whole, whereas you think of significance at kind of like more the standards or the topic level?
No, the best example is what we had, what we ended up doing for the proposal and leases, where we said anything less than a year you don't have to put on the balance sheet. If in the U.S., if we had said you only have to reflect material leases, we would have forced companies to track every single lease, and they would have to then evaluate every lease that was under a year, and then prove that by not recording it, it was not material to the financial statements taken as a whole. When you force companies to do that analysis, there is if you're doing the cut from a cost-benefit standpoint, they have the cost because they have to prove that not recording was not material in the financial statements taken as a whole. So the thought is the standard setter just makes a cut, and in essence, we make the cut for materiality to take cost out of the system. But generally, it is financial statements taken as a whole.
Clemens, can I just address on integrated reporting, Kim, we are on the council, Ellen's on the working group, we've got a memorandum, so we're aware of the issue, but probably at this stage South Africa is the only place in the world where it's being applied, so we're watching, we're aware of the issue. Clemens?
Thank you. At the high level, I also like to commend the board on picking up this disclosure initiative. I think both from the timeliness and the approach angle, I definitely, you know, sort of see the logic of it. You know, as far as time is concerned, if we're looking at the conceptual framework right now, I think the disclosure initiative is very timely exercise. As far as that approach is concerned, you did mention about your effort in talking to IOSCO and IAASB on this. I think it's very, very important to have some sort of dialogue and understanding with those two organizations as far as the subject matter is concerned. After all, materiality would be a very matter close matter very close to their heart as well. Well, as far as the lay down approach of the project that you've done, I also echo the concern raised by Francois about, you know, the differentiation between short term and long term thing. Well, there may be practical issues that you have considered in order to divide this approach in terms of timing, but when you look at the review of IAS 7-8 and the financial statement presentation and the holistic approach of other standard, I don't think you really need to to do it at different time. It might be more fruitful if you try to do it together with when you review the materiality issue. But obviously, the other end of the other end of the consideration scale is you know, the resources, the time that you might need to accomplish that. That is understandable. Also on the last slide that you said, you showed that the conceptual framework and the and the disclosure initiative. I think, as I mentioned earlier, it's very logical to see the correlation between those two projects. But however, from as a concern, I don't know whether tying that up will have some sort of implication on the timing of issues as well. If we, you know, if we're trying to say that the the project or what the initiative, the disclosure initiative project, need to be tied in as far as the issuing tied with the conceptual framework. Then we might have a lot of challenge as well because of trying to monitor the simultaneous progress of the two projects.
The other thing that's driving the time, which I didn't mention, was bringing those research projects onto the agenda as well, so bringing them on to the next agenda consultation and getting them on as an active project, so making sure that by the time we get to that point that we have a clear idea of what we want to achieve and you know, have done a lot of the research so that the actual project, when we can get it onto the active agenda, can move forward a lot more quickly. So I get your point about it being tied to the conceptual framework, but there's other reasons as well that are driving, say, the two research projects in terms of time frame.
Obviously, the challenge is when you get one almost done, mm-hmm. and the other is still halfway through, then you might need to drag on the progress of the other one so as to push it out or roll it out, at almost the same time.
Hopefully, if we work, we can sort of minimise any sort of drag, or we can make sure they're aligned as possible, depending on whatever timeline one or the other is going to. But at least we feel that working on them in parallel, at least for some time, should mean that at least any differences are minimised, and any differences in timelines or problems arising from that difference in timeline would also be minimised.
And as a last comment at the high level, I think there's a lot of support among our region on this initiative. Can I just go down to the issues thing? Two comments that I'd like to make at this stage. Firstly, is about the suggestion of looking at the net debt. Mm-hmm. I guess very much similar to Kevin's comment. The way we look at it is if one look at the materiality language and on at the disclosure initiative and apply it diligently, all those issues that need to be highlighted from the materiality angle would have been would get their way to the notes anyhow. So I question whether you need to sort of teed up this net debt issue. Like Kevin was saying, there might be many other issues that that the preparers or the users might want to look at, in certain specific situation. So I guess the justification of raising this net debt as something that we need to look at, as a separate issue is not strong enough. And also on the materiality, the you did mention on your paper as well that there's a lot of understanding out there in the market that the materiality or disclosure requirement at specific standard level, actually a lot of people take it as having a preference or over the general materiality, sort of statement that in IAS 1. I think the reality is out there that a lot of people take the specific standard requirement as having a stronger, sort of a weight on the IAS 1 thing. That in itself generate a lot of the development of boilerplate, sort of disclosure in the market right now. In Hong Kong, if you look at a lot of listed companies in Hong Kong, if you don't get the notes, it's almost like a copying from each other. So definitely, I think it's a good thing to look at it now and try to sort of tell people that hey, what we mean is only those material items in terms of disclosure need to be disclosed appropriately, rather than that we provide a template for you to copy as such.
You.
Thank you. Generally, we agree with the disclosure initiative you proposed. I have some comments on the materiality and the order of the notes. First comment is on the materiality. With as we all are aware that this notion materiality is very important in IFRS. Although we all acknowledge that the IFRS is principle based and we need many judgment in practice when we are applying the notion of materiality, but we still hope the SB could provide more guidance on the materiality, because we always heard from the stakeholders in China that they need more guidance when they are applying these standards. This is the first comment on materiality. In addition, we also got some comments from the auditors in China. Maybe you are aware that the IWSB International Accounting, International Auditing and Assurance Standards Board. They are now making some changes to the materiality, and this notion materiality is also very important in the auditing standards. Although this notion plays different roles in accounting standards and auditing standards, but the auditors in China, they really want to see some coordination between the two boards and the two set of standards. That's a second comment on the materiality. As for the order of the notes, I agree with Alexandra's comments that please don't change the normal like to could, for example, in paragraph 114, because we think that the order of the notes is very important and very helpful both for the preparers and for the users. And we think it's if you propose to change the normal to could, for example, then the paragraph 114 is more like an example rather than a requirement. Mm-hmm. So we don't think it's appropriate for this paragraph to stay in the IS1 according to your proposal. So,
and we'll talk about those specific disclosures in a minute after Amy's done the sort of presentation. And that was actually an interesting point because the board, there were different views on the board on that one.
So. Okay, I just want to say something. Okay, so we think that if you still use the normal, like use these words, it doesn't matter. And there is no conflict between the paragraph 114 and the 115, because paragraph 115 says in some circumstances it may be necessary or desirable to vary the order of specific items within the notes. So I think it's okay.
There is enough flexibility.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, there were mixed views in the board on this.
Yeah. Yes.
Mike and then Roger.
I just want to pick up a couple of bits that Kim and Russ mentioned around materiality. We're talking about, you know, is it single line items or is it the financial statements as a whole? Because I think both of those are very quantitative concepts. And I think the underlying importance of this is actually a qualitative one, not a quantitative one, i.e. does it affect the view of the users of the accounts in terms of how they are interpreting the data? And I think it's important that you try and stay at that level and not get dragged down into distinguishing whether or not, you know, you're looking at particular bits of information. That leads me on to say I very much welcome the idea you try and stick as objective level as possible. I have some minor sympathy with the view that auditors therefore say, well, how the hell do we apply it? Perhaps it might force them to use the judgment they get paid for. I can say that now because I'm no longer an auditor. But I do think that, therefore, I quite like Alan's idea that if you give examples and you give a multitude of examples, so people have to pick one or the other or something completely different, actually that helps, not driving everyone down a checklist approach. And I think that helps Alan's point that, you know, if you've got more than one way of presenting the information given to you, And
we just have to confuse them thoroughly.
Well, I and to come to the point about short term, long term, and the point about are we going to go down the right road from day one, or are we going to have to track a little bit? I think the sooner you can actually apply the sorts of thinking that you've got to one or two standards, perhaps ones which are currently in development, that therefore the results of which can be picked up in a post-implementation review in the not too distant future, that would be a way to start to push the agenda. But I think, frankly, unless the boards are brave, nothing's going to change.
I just reflect there, because I actually value your comments and about the objective in particular. I think it links back a little bit to Kevin's paper later on today. We're at risk, if we're not careful, of being boilerplate ourselves by saying that the objective is to help assess the timing uncertainty of cash flows. We actually have to explain why it might affect the timing uncertainty of cash flows. And I suspect, and this came out very strongly at the forum, the clearer your objective, it's much easier then to contextualise materiality, because you can explain why it's important to understand that concept. So, and I'll just give you an example. IS16 doesn't have an objective; it just says disclosure. The entity shall disclose, and it lists. And again, that goes back to that. I was going to ask a question as we wrap up when we get towards the end of the day, whether we should think in terms of timing, should accelerate a review of existing requirements where they do look a bit prescriptive. Because I've heard that from a few people saying, look, it doesn't matter what you do with materiality, we've got these words in here. So I'd be interested in thinking about whether we should accelerate or not. But the importance of the objective, I think, is worth emphasising.
Roger, I'm worried about you telling us to be brave. You know, people don't like us when we're brave. Have a look at Lisa.
Yes, yeah, Lisa.
There's a big difference here between being brave and being foolhardy.
Yeah, we never go any further than brave. We seldom get there.
It's courageous you have to worry about it.
Just a couple of reflections on what I've heard. I agree with Kim about identifying who the users are, at least who you're mainly aiming this at. And I think there's something in the more detailed paper saying that some users say they just want to do a very quick comparison of financial statements without ever getting into any detail. Now, I'm not sure that we should mainly be addressing disclosures or our disclosure principles of those sort of users. So I think it's almost worth having a user in mind, perhaps someone who is an investor who's actually looking in detail at the financial statements. Otherwise, because they're general purpose financial statements and there are so many different possible users, you could end up with an extremely long list of disclosures, or indeed perhaps the wrong sort of disclosures. On the question of regulators, I agree with what's been said already, and some regulators will almost say you have to prove to us that this is not material. It's almost the wrong way around. And so I do think the language needs to give preparers and auditors the ability to push back on that. So I don't think we're in the right place at the moment. And I may be wrong on this, I'm trying to remember the ESMA consultation document on materiality. But I think it was postulating that the materiality was that something might influence a user. Something that might influence a user, there's an awful lot of things that might influence a user. Mm. So I think we need to make that whatever we say, or whatever you say, needs to get that balance right.
But you've put your finger on the problem. I mean, we've spent all our time looking at users' needs over the last while, and we spent a lot of time out with users, consulting with them. But you do get a variety of views, and you're right, there's different sorts of users. Mm. And trying to work out which one you're really trying to help isn't all that simple.
But I think
it's a good objective.
It's important to have an objective. I don't want to get into the leasing, but someone said to me that, I never read the footnotes, therefore it's very important to me that leases are on the balance sheet. Now, there's lots of good reasons to have leases on the balance sheet, but I don't regard that as the
thought you
the
had a motivation here, Roger. Keep going.
We'll leave leases till tomorrow. Finally, I'd like to speak in favour of the net debt reconciliation. When I talk to users, at least in the UK, they mainly identify that as the single most important disclosure that's not there. And I think we're here on a journey between a lot of disclosures may not be absolutely necessary, but also there are some disclosures not made at the moment which are important. It's moving to more quality disclosure. So if you could balance perhaps taking some of these things out, that the quick exercise that Mike was talking about, perhaps on IS16, about perhaps improving some disclosures. You could at the same time be bringing in disclosures that aren't required at the moment, but which are important. So it's a question of rebalancing rather than just clashing.
Equal?
Okay. Materiality. We support the amendment of IS1's wording change, but we also don't think that solved the materiality issues. So everybody in this table shared that not only the behavior of preparers, but also the auditors, the defensive attitude, big obstacles to solve this issue under the very strict environment of market supervision. So, but maybe nobody had a cure or solution. So what you can do as an international organization, maybe you already think about talk, share the with IWSB and IASCO to reach some common common materiality concept.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up from a couple of Roger's comments, because I think the really critical observations that we're not actually writing about in the DP, but they're fundamental to the framework. I think at this meeting, the meeting of this group, the first time, I tried to get across the notion that identifying common user needs was a very subtle but important part of the framework. And I think at IFAS somebody expressed the danger of multi-user needs with unlimited serving of those needs, which is a different model again. So if employees might want some information, okay, we better put that in. If shareholders might need some information to value certain types of equities, we should put that in. Rather than a common user need approach, which, you know, is really trying to look at the building blocks that the users with different purposes can use for their purposes. And I think we ought to be explicit about our philosophy on that. The second point was on the sophistication of the user. We're often assailed by people that say, you know, mums and dads have got no chance of using these financial statements. And each of us has probably had to defend that situation at some point. The way I try to defend that, I might cause a debate here with, I don't know. But I try to rationalise it in terms of efficient markets work, which suggests that a relatively small number of sophisticated users in the market will bid away insider gains. And so by aiming at the more sophisticated user, you're actually protecting the less sophisticated user.
Of course.
But we don't say that very much in our framework, and then we keep getting crucified because we're not serving, being seen to serve mums and dads.
I think it's good to be quite open on that. I mean, if you look at the annual budget of a nation state, how many people actually read that? A couple of parliamentarians, and only partially. But it affects everybody. Does that make the annual statement or the annual budget not significant? Of course, it's extremely significant, but it goes through a whole process. And I think you have to address necessarily the sophisticated user, because these documents are necessarily extremely sophisticated, and no way we can simplify it. We can simplify. We do make things unnecessarily complicated, but they will always remain complicated and sophisticated.
Yeah.
I think now move to Amy's paper, which goes to ask you some specific questions about the proposed amendments to IS1 that we brought to the board in September.
So this is agenda paper 1B3 for this meeting, which is a copy of that September 2013 board paper. It might be labelled as 8B. And we have five amendments in this paper, which we asked the board about during the September board meeting. And as Christy said, the amendments are clarifying amendments to address what we think are overly literal interpretations of IS1. Sorry. So at this session, we wanted to go through those proposed amendments and then ask you a few questions, and specifically want to know what you think of the amendments, whether you think they'll make a difference, and whether there are any other amendments to IS1 that you think we can make as part of this project. So at the September 4th meeting, the board did agree with all of the amendments subject to drafting changes. There were two which generated more discussion, so I wanted to talk about those in more detail later and just go over the other three now. So firstly, we proposed an amendment to address the perception that IS1, and specifically paragraph 54, which lists line items for presentation in the statement of financial position, requires presentation of the line items as listed in that paragraph. For example, this paragraph lists intangible assets as a line item, and some entities feel this means that they cannot disaggregate this line item into goodwill and other intangible assets. So we recommended that paragraph 54 be amended to clarify that the line items listed in that paragraph can be disaggregated and should be disaggregated if it provides more relevant information. And we also recommended that a similar amendment be made to paragraph 82 of IS1, which deals with presentation of the line items in profit or loss. The second amendment is to address language in IS1, which is perceived of making it difficult to argue that an accounting policy is insignificant. And specifically, this is the income taxes example that IS1 says, which is a user would expect an entity subject to income taxes to disclose its accounting policies for income taxes. And so we thought that contradicted some of the guidance given in IS1 for what a significant accounting policy is. So we recommended removing that example. Lastly, we proposed an amendment to include wording in the materiality guidance to increase awareness of how disclosing immaterial information could obscure useful information. And this amendment is to address the problems that we've heard with regards to too much irrelevant information being disclosed and how, as we've talked about, materiality not being applied as well as it could be in practice. So firstly, we just wanted to ask you what you thought about those amendments.
Take us to the questions. Which questions is it?
Oh, sorry, so this is in the paper it would be. That would be question 2 in the paper, question 3, and question 5.
The board of those.
Yeah.
On the issue of the revision of the paragraph 54 and also 82, that we support from what you try to be doing, but a question as to whether you're not going to get, you know, you have in your paper at an earlier stage identified that having at least or as a minimum income disclosure requirements in a few standards. That was a supplementary hurdle in the way materiality would be applied. I was wondering whether you needed to have as a minimum to start with in those two paragraphs.
Liesl? Well, we've been around that yesterday or the day before, I can't remember, and saying that maybe it's a question of the order too. If you start by more or less saying something like as a minimum, a number of people would immediately see that as a must. Mm-hmm. And if only later on you say, well, if it doesn't really fit, maybe not, some people would say you have to first of all give the different flavor that this is not a shopping list, but it is a possible list. So if starting by as a minimum. You set a hurdle, people immediately jump to, and that's it. So I think there's a bit of psychology in how you sequence that. And then, as we said before, you have to state somewhere that as a minimum is subject to materiality too. And you have to hang that either very high or repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. But starting like this, you get people on the wrong track.
Yeah, that was actually the point that I wanted to make as well, because although the proposed amendment to 54 clarifies that you can disaggregate, what happens if intangible assets are not material for a particular entity and maybe nor trade in other receivables? So you've got that dilemma again around saying, but goodness, I now have to, even if it's not material. So I have to go both ways.
So taking those comments, we could just cut out as a minimum and just start with the statement of financial position shall include, or would we need to put some softer language?
Well, I think the comment that's made, and I'm just trying to remember where it is, about the overall materiality, I suppose it's always needs to be subject to that. So assuming that it is material, then yes, one would expect to see those line items. But if intangible assets aren't even material to an entity, well,
yeah,
they're not going to be presented separately on the face of the statement of financial position. Yeah.
That would be brave, wouldn't it?
But we're being courageous. What do we mean?
Man got as far as brave.
Alexander? On question five, I know that it's mentioned in paragraph 119, but at least for my taste, it would be better to be clear that you should not disclose an accounting policy unless there is an option. And at least I am correct. Do you agree with me?
No, I think that might be a circumstance that you think it might be significant. I don't think it's the only reason why you may or may not disclose an accounting policy.
Something that's very relevant, it's very material, but I don't have a choice. I just have to follow the standard. Should I disclose there's an accounting policy?
I think we were talking about, say, if I take this paragraph 120 that we have here, we were looking at should we exclude the discussion here about the foreign operations or transactions.
I understand, but
there you don't have an option, but we felt that gave you some sort of indication about the nature of the entity, so therefore could be significant. So that's why we didn't exclude that. So I don't think...
No, I understand and I agree with that. I'm just going one step ahead and say that should I disclose the policy, something that there is no option embedded in it?
And it's
not a suggestion. I'm saying clearly that so accounting policies are accounting treatments that the company has an option within IFRS. They should not disclose something that they don't have an option. At least my view, the accounting policy was.
And I say wrong. I think there'd be other circumstances where something might be significant, even if you didn't have an option. So if I took that foreign currency example,
but for a person I have options, and I agree with you. I'm just thinking about a general statement. What an accounting policy is.
But there's no accounting policy. Choice for foreign operations.
No, you have depend on.
No, I don't think there's an option for foreign currency translation.
No, but if you can hedge it or not, there's a lot of.
I think there is a discussion whether we have this here in the broader, not here. I'm not sure that discussion sits in a clarifying amendment, because I think it goes to what is a significant accounting policy. And I think there's a big issue with that, and people debate that in many ways. So I think it would be something we could discuss in our broader disclosure framework project. Mm. Because I think it's a valid question, and people would say, is that a way that we could... decrease the size of some of those accounting policies by one, for example, just limiting it to where the entity has an option to apply a certain accounting treatment.
But currently, in your view, I should disclose things that I do not have options.
Yeah, if it's
something very long.
but I think it can give you information about the characteristics of that entity, or it could be so significant for that entity.
I understand that's the current status quo
today is there to see long pages of accounting policies. There are no policies, it's just replicating the standard. No?
And I don't, you know, in options like how you might have applied something, for example. So what is your depreciation policy? Even though you have to depreciate, what is your depreciation policy? You know, is that an option or is that just an application of an IFRS? I think it's not an unimportant
disclosure, I would say.
So it's an issue, but maybe a bigger issue than what we're dealing with in this amendment.
Ross?
Thanks. I'm focused on question two, specifically the amendment that was proposed in paragraph 30A. I think I understand the objective, which I think in the last sentence you're changing the mindset that I think would take one away from a checklist mentality that would say you'd have to evaluate all of the disclosures and that would force people to use judgment as to the totality of it. My question is did the board have any discussion about how the second sentence may conflict with existing IFRS? I'll throw out the example that Alan talked about earlier in the meeting of IAS 16, which it says, at a minimum, an entity shall do the following. If an entity did that and then got to the point where this last sentence was that it could obfuscate, the irrelevant could obfuscate the relevant, it seems like there's a conflict there. And what happens when there's a conflict? Does the preparer choose? Does the preparer do the most recent? Was there any discussion of that?
There wasn't any discussion in the
board. Not with conflicts, but there was a drafting suggestion. It was slightly different in terms of, I think we said, do you apply materiality to a particular topic or something? But there was some, I think some wording that we came out with was more positive. This came across as being a bit negative. It didn't change what we were trying to do, but it was a slightly...
Generally, in the U.S., anyway... materiality is almost, for lack of better words, if something's immaterial, you have the option to exclude it. If you include it, you will be okay. If you exclude it, you then have to do an assessment that says it's okay to exclude. The way I read the second sentence is you no longer have the option to exclude the immaterial items. You no longer have the option to separately present immaterial items. You must aggregate that with something else, which I would view maybe in conflict with other disclosures that say at a minimum you must disclose. But I like what you're trying to do here because I think it will reduce the checklist mentality.
Well, I suppose it was the same point.
It's the same.
I wanted to take it a little further. I mean, we're slightly, I think, jumping to and fro.
Yeah.
With the sequence of whatever you do in the notes, I think something has not come up lately other than in Germany, people saying they don't want really to have that section on the accounting policies up front, but have the accounting policies, subject to our discussion, if there are choices or not, when you explain your specific item. Because having this front block takes a lot of space, and once you get down 20, 25 pages later, you have to flip back again to see, oh, that was their overall accounting policy on IFRS 2, and now I'm on the IFRS 2 or something like that. So there could be at least some rationalization. Of course, you leave the focal point of all the accounting policies in one place, but given that you might more or less safely assume that people know the broad accounting policy choices in IFRS anyway, if you really want to depict your own entity, couldn't it be better and more concise if you do it in the place where you're really talking about the numbers too?
And I think that's the order question which we'll get on to. But we've heard that message. We'll get on to that. But that was another point that was raised at the board meeting. Sorry.
Thank you. I'm happy to follow up from Liesl on this point because, in fact, we prepared for this session on the basis of your feedback statement where this kind of IS 1 amendments were outlined. And indeed, there was quite a lot of support for keeping in the accounting policy section only what is entity-specific. Mm-hmm. So what everybody has to apply when material, when significant, this should be considered as being knowledge. And indeed, when we went a bit further into the discussion, the fact that the best place for an accounting policy explanation is where the information is presented so that you have the two together has had a lot of support. There have been, however, some people to highlight the fact that it is quite helpful when the annual report is a full set of information and you don't have to look. Mm-hmm. If you're not knowledgeable enough, you don't have to look somewhere else to find the description of the accounting policies used. Some also have said, well, I mean, for researchers, you know, you look at the annual statements sometime later. You not necessarily have in your mind every what the accounting policies were a particular year. So maybe that's something that the ISB could have on their website for each year, what the accounting policies that everybody applies. You know, the summaries that you would find in the annual report could be available. Something that you may think of. But definitely the perspective was, in the annual report you should have what is entity specific, not what, when, and there is no choice when, no need to repeat what I first have to say.
Clemens?
Thank you. In general, we agree with the proposed amendments on paragraph 38 and 54. In particular, the first sentence of 38, but the second sentence, I think it might need to refine for provision of further clarity. Mm-hmm. And on paragraph 54, I don't know whether you need to insert that example at the end. For separate line items for goodwill and other intangibles could replace the intangible assets listed in paragraph C above.
We put it there just to be clear what we're trying to articulate.
Yeah, I know your intention, but whether that served the purpose or not, I doubt it.
Do you think we need to... Would it be sufficient to take out that example, or would you think what we're trying to achieve?
Personally, I think the first sentence is good enough.
Mm. Okay.
The example is consistent with one of the illustrative examples in the back of IS1, so we thought it was a fairly innocuous thing to use there. But
Roger?
Very common. I quite like the example, but it's a matter of personal taste here. I just wanted to agree with Alexandra and Francois about the accounting policy point. And it almost goes back to what users are we aiming at. Now, in the old days, you know, when every country had its own accounting standards, it was important for international users to understand just what accounting policy is being applied. IFRS is now, in most jurisdictions, pretty universal. So if we're aiming this thing at sophisticated users, to take Kevin's point, they don't need a teaching which differs marginally by company of what IFRS, what a summary of IFRS is. What people want to know is, if there's an option, what option have we used? Has there been a change in accounting policy? And if there's then an application information, like this is how we've applied the depreciation standard, they want to know that. But it's a complete turn-off, particularly as it's at the start of the footnote, to have to go through 20 pages of accounting policies which just summarise IFRS. And I'm afraid that this example, which takes us from one case where there's absolutely no option to another case where there's absolutely no option, doesn't actually help. You know, because and if you say, well, it helps you to understand the group, you shouldn't need to read the accounting policy to find out the group's got overseas businesses. You know, I mean, that's hopefully going to be clear from somewhere else in financial statements. I would not have an accounting policy on foreign exchange. There is absolutely no option, and I apply it.
And picking up that message from a number of you, do you think we could deal with that in this project by maybe, for example, taking out that example of foreign operations? Or do you think we need to go further and do some more work on what is a significant accounting policy and do something more on that? And would that fit into this project? Or is it something we could pick up? These projects or these streams that I've talked about are what we're proposing now. That perhaps could be another one, or is it something we feel that we could actually do pretty quickly?
Well, my view is you can do it pretty quickly, but I might be alone.
Anna?
Yes. In relation to accounting policies, I share the comments that have been raised, and also I think that changes in accounting policies and the ethics of those changes should be given prominence.
Françoise?
I wanted to respond to the question raised by Christy. I mean, I think if you were going the route we're suggesting, you would need to revise the wording of the current paragraph, because, you know, on what we believe should be disclosed, you describe as being especially, so suggesting clearly that it's more particularly this, but not only. And so we really suggesting a very different route, so that the question of whether a policy is significant, as long as it is the same policy for everybody, I mean, we would just not disclose it at all. So it would be a complete different wording you would hear.
Tom?
I think to effectuate behavioral change, you really have to write it differently and say that the objective is to describe where there's choices. I think choices cover both options and application, but where there's choices, and that's what should be disclosed. I find reading accounting policy footnotes mind-numbing and false communication. There is no way that anyone can summarize what the guidance is in IFRS or any other standard in a way that doesn't incompletely describe what the requirements are. And so you're ciphering through it, and you're trying to say, well, did they really not follow the guidance by writing it in a summarized fashion? Or are they telling me that they did something unusual, and I'm trying to ferret out, was the summarization the problem or unusual the problem? I think it's a really big issue about effective communication. And flipping it the other way to say, just describe your choices, and only those choices would be far, far more effective communication and remove a lot of mind-numbing extra pages.
Russ, yes?
One of the Tom's exactly correct. And one of the additional things that I'm that we one of the things we did in the in the U.S. Is we link XBRL to the codification, yeah. So that under the philosophy that we didn't want everyone to have the same disclosures on revenue recognitions or whatever, and this is primarily an educational thing for the investors about what the policy was. They could go to the XBRL line item, link to the codification, and see to some degree what was the accounting requirement.
Okay. Oh, yes, good.
Yeah, I think to add to that and to pick up on the suggestion that Francois made, you know, I think that talk about where we've got, you know, clear accounting policies, be it for property, plant and equipment, to investment property, etc., that I think it's actually quite a good idea if the ISB actually has those disclosed. But if, for example, maybe there's a transaction the company enters into on common control transactions, or something where we don't have an accounting standard which really has a clear accounting policy, well, then clearly those the entity would need to include, or as you say, where there are choices. So it's almost to say, well, you know, those are the stock standard ones, then you can look to those. If there's a choice there, this is what I've done, and obviously if that doesn't cover something, then this is what I've done for those. I certainly think that sounds like a good way forward.
So we end the morning session with
Can I just almost here, and I don't know if anybody's got it. The whole of paragraph 120 could come out almost, rather than change the wording, because all it does is says you should disclose that you expect to be associated with the entity, but all those issues about choice of policy, measurement, and estimates and stuff are captured in the previous paragraph, which I know you don't have 119. So, I'm getting a sense of this is a really helpful thing to do with policies, but we're shortchanging ourselves just a little bit by only taking out one example. We could do a bit more. But with all these things, we want this to be relatively an easy ride
for us. We don't want to distract by going too far in this part of the project either.
Oops.
When Amy teed up, she only teed up 3 of the 5 questions. So are we going to do that, or are we going to go to one? I wasn't sure which.
We've got the controversial. We've got the structuring one. I think we can do that after lunch.
And materiality.
And materiality. There are 2 issues to come back to.
Oh, but net debt.
And net debt, I think, is the last one. Yeah. To my list.
Can I just make it? You're saying delete 120, but in fact, 121 is often misinterpreted as we better give an accounting policy of things we don't even have, just in case we might have it in the future. So people will put in a lease accounting policy, and they don't have any leases.
Yeah.
I'm wondering whether 121 is not sending the wrong signal.
Yeah, but I'm wondering whether what we're talking about, whether we don't need to kind of sit back and think about it.
I agree. Yeah.
You know, picking this and taking out that sentence. And
yeah, you're right.
119 needs to be changed.
Okay. This is a good moment to break for lunch.
I think because the idea would be we come back, I think, it is. We've got 3 issues that were more controversial. One is the structuring and the notion of consistency of the notes order presentation, because as we'll meet, you know, if there was not a conflict, but we got mixed signals from some work that EFRAG did compared to the work that we did, and it's come up at the table. Second, about the way of expressing materiality, I think the other one is worthwhile because we haven't taken net debt to the board yet. We're still preparing the papers, and we have 4 potential staff recommendations in mind. And so that will be something I think we'll get a little bit of feedback. And then we go to paper from Kevin and have a look at more general framework from that.
But are you going to propose another version for the 120?
No, not. I think we've got the sentiment about what people are saying. We've got to work out whether we can do some drafting of that is going to be helpful, or whether it's going to be distract out trying to get some relatively small changes through. We don't want this to be held hostage to one or 2 things.
1 o'clock? But we break till 1 o'clock, and then we'll resume our meeting on this clock.
Right. And I am.